While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the
eye. And welcome, dear listeners. Apologies once again if I've blasted your ears, your eardrums into the next realm or dimension. But I'm glad to welcome you guys to this Tuesday edition of the On the Radar here on your number one talk radio station. And obviously, as mentioned, this is your drive time discussion as we take you all the way from 1 p.m. or afternoon or midday session up until 2:30 this afternoon. Now, this is obviously as we do this daily from Monday to Friday here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. Now, starting off, before we actually get into the particular, menu that we've got lined up for you, just to let you know, dear listeners, you can listen to us from wherever, whenever, across the world, and even across Namibia, specifically if you've got a strong enough data plan on the Eagle FM application. It's a very small download to make. Specifically, go to any of the particular platforms of the Apple, Play Store, or specifically the Android Play Store itself, the Google Play, Android Play Store, and download the small, very small download in terms of the Eagle FM application. Alternatively, tune in on your favorite frequency wherever you find us across the country and listen to your favorite programming. Now, also do remember that this is every Tuesday, technically, up until a certain point, either next week or the week after, will be your Villager e-paper eve, meaning the day before. So look forward to tomorrow's edition of the e-paper to come out tomorrow morning. Or, for those of you that have subscribed to us, Early Bird obviously does catch the worm. Now, starting off in earnest and getting us into the lined up menu for today's particular engagement, we take a look at some of the particular talking points that come from the recent announcement by the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sport, Arts and Culture, that being MESAC, in terms of the announcement of the subsidization of tertiary education from 2026 onwards. We also step into an interactive discussion, or an in-depth discussion specifically, with a representative from Namibia at the Young Women of Africa conference currently taking place in Addis Ababa. As well as also then we get into an engagement with Eagle FM's own Anakleta Hekera regarding the recent developments stemming from the local and the regional authority elections in terms of where Kafangwe East, surprise, 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 elected in 3 independent candidates. And on that note, it will bring us up towards the end of the top of the hour at 2 o'clock, whereby we'll be getting into the international news segment. Do remember, dear listeners, that there is no participation in Ramadan, i.e. the particular terminology used by my partner in crime, Helmut. However, you can come through right after the local news engagements at 083-288-401. Right here in the studio. Let's have a listen. Let's engage and let's see what you guys have on the forefronts of your minds. We're going to take a short, very short break, and we come back right after that.
While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Now we come back to listeners from the quick break right there. And as mentioned, you're here in the company of the On the Radar team, specifically with myself, Dwight, all the way from 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. this afternoon. Starting off with our first discussion this afternoon, we get into the announcement coming through from the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture, MASAC, who formally announced the subsidization of the tertiary education in Namibia. Now, the Minister Sanet Steenkamp highlighted that on 24 April 2025, that President Nandi Ndaitwa, during her particular maiden speech at the State of the Nation address, cited that the goal of the 8th administration would be to provide 100% subsidization of tertiary education. Now, this announcement follows months after the announcement that was first made back at the start of the year by the president shortly after swearing in and the establishment of her 8th administration's cabinet. Much speculation had been circling across the country on how this bold initiative would be implemented, and this particular announcement came through with Minister Steenkamp signaling the direction that the broad subsidization would take and the strategy that would be associated with it. Let's have a listen to what she explained.
Pleased to announce that from the next academic year, commencing 2026, tertiary education will become 100% subsidized and no tuition fees at all public universities and technical and vocational education centers. While this will be a gradual phased-in approach, your contribution as families and students for now will be towards accommodation and other related costs. We have heard your cries. Fees have fallen. This landmark public policy pronouncement signaled a bold policy shift aimed of widening access to tertiary education and advancing social equity. In the line of this pronouncement of Her Excellency the President of the Republic of Namibia, the Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture appointed a task force with a mandate to develop the technical, financial and policy frameworks necessary for the phased-in implementation of the subsidized funding for students at tertiary education institutions. The task force report was compiled after in-depth and extensive deliberations and after consultations with diverse stakeholders in the tertiary education and other sectors. The consulted stakeholders included the President of the Republic of Namibia, Excellency Dr. Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa, Honorable Erika Shafuda, Minister of Finance and the team, the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, Association of Private Higher Education Institutions in Namibia, the Association of Technical and Vocational Education and Training Institutions in Namibia, the Namibian National Students Organization, National African Students Association, Students Union of Namibia, the Namibia Public Workers Union, as well as Bank Windhoek, Bankers Association of Namibia, African Peer Review Mechanism, Namibia Institute for Democracy, and the Association of African Higher Education Financing Agencies. More than 17 various meetings were conducted, initial consultations. Following careful consideration, the Cabinet approved the subsidized tertiary education funding model in line with the President's pronouncement at the 31st Cabinet meeting on the 2nd of December 2025. Student subsidized tertiary education is defined as follows. It is defined as a funding model whereby students do not pay registration or tuition fees for their primary undergraduate qualifications. That is for an NQF level 1 to 6 at private and public and private higher education institutions. Let me start that one. Student subsidized tertiary education is defined as a funding model whereby students do not pay registration or tuition fees for their primary undergraduate qualification at the NQF level 5 to 8, including honors at public and private higher education institutions. And vocational. Don't forget, vocational training centers, level 1 to 6, NQA accredited. Can we also have a round of applause for that? So that is the true definition. To ensure fairness, equity, and inclusiveness across the whole tertiary education sector, the subsidized tertiary education funding model was extended to include private institutions. Furthermore, it was found necessary to maintain tuition funding for non-tuition fees such as accommodation, meals, transport, learning materials, and other resources for students in public and private tertiary education institutions as per the existing NSFAF modality with a specific amendment. The need was identified to ensure that needy students are covered in terms of providing non-tuition fees as loans through means testing to enhance access through a holistic approach to student funding.
Now, coming back from that particular first indication by the recent announcement by the Minister of MESAC, that being Sir Ned Steenkamp, Steenkamp also continued to outline the conditions under which the prospective Namibians who wish to pursue the tertiary education would be scrutinized under, and the further measures that would become applicable in the enrollment processes to public and private institutions. We'll have a listen to what she adds.
What is the eligible criteria for funding? The following categories will be eligible for funding. 1. All undergraduate students who do their first primary qualification at an NQF level 5 up to a level 8, including honours at public and private higher education institutions, will receive 100% tuition and registration fee subsidy. 2. All trainees for the first primary trade, NQF level 1 up to level 6 at TVET centers will be accorded with 100% tuition and registration subsidy. A first primary qualification is defined as the first qualification attained by student at the NQF level 1 to 6 for those pursuing technical, vocational and training education, or for those pursuing higher education, NQF level 5 to 8, including an honors degree. A bridging program that is required to qualify for the primary qualification is part of the primary qualification. Number 3, students pursuing courses abroad in priority fields of study, but such courses are not offered by tertiary education institutions in Namibia. Priority fields. What are the exclusion criteria for funding? The following categories will not be eligible for funding. Number 1. Students pursuing second or more qualifications at the same or lower NQF level. Funding for repeating students at any level shall be discontinued. Non-Namibian citizens are not eligible for funding. Number four, student enrolled at institutions and or in programs that are not meeting legal and quality standard requirements according to the approved national quality standards as implemented by the National Council for Higher Education, the Namibia Qualifications Authority and the Namibia Training Authority shall not be eligible for funding. So there are conditions. Students pursuing courses abroad that are in priority fields of study, but that are offered in tertiary education institutions within Namibia. Postgraduate studies. Until any further notice, postgraduate studies will not be funded under the subsidized tertiary education funding model. And the reason for this decision is to allow for ample time for the development of a national list of priority fields of study, which will serve as a key eligibility criterion for future postgraduate funding. In addition, other eligibility criteria will be identified and applied to the funding of postgraduate studies. Postgraduate students currently funded through the means-tested loans from the Namibia Students Financial Assistance Fund will continue to receive support until they complete their studies in accordance with the existing student financial assistance and debt recovery policy and in its accompanying procedures and the priority fields of study that was for 2021 to 2025.
Still on that matter, Steenkamp also clarified that the non-tuition items would still be dispensed to students on a loan-based agreement, as these would fall outside of the scope of the proposed subsidy. We take a listen.
In terms of non-tuition fees, again, we wish to state students and trainees under the subsidized tertiary education funding model in tertiary education institutions shall be accorded non-tuition fees as loans through means testing. Funding for non-tuition will be provided in line with the current approved student financial assistance and debt recovery policy and accompanying procedures. The combined parental or guardian income threshold for funding is currently set at 500,000 Namibia dollars. This threshold will reduce to 100,000 Namibia dollars and therefore caters for the most needy students. The non-tuition fee will still be at an amount of 17,000 Namibia dollars per annum. How are we going to make sure as a country that we maintain the quality of education? Ladies and gentlemen, esteemed students, members of the public who are watching this, only students enrolled at institutions that meet the minimum standards for higher education institutions, the national policy and qualification standards, and the regulations for registration of vocational education and training providers of 2012, government notice 300 of 2012, are eligible for funding under the subsidized tertiary education funding model. And this particularly pertains to registration fees, tuition fees, and non-tuition fees. Now, what is the minimum standards for higher education? Can we a little bit deliberate on that? The minimum standards for higher education institutions were approved by Cabinet in 2025 at the 26th Cabinet meeting. The standards for baseline requirements for all types of higher education providers in the system, hence promoting inclusion and enhancing equal access to quality education, while at the same time ensuring integrity and trust in the Namibian higher education system nationally, regionally, and globally. These standards aim to establish a minimum uniform baseline for institutional quality and program delivery, enhance public confidence, but also promote regional and international recognition of Namibian qualifications. In addition, the National Policy on Qualification Standards was approved by Cabinet in 2025 at the 30th Cabinet meeting. The policy seeks to harmonize qualifications developments and establish a minimum body of knowledge and skill sets for each qualification area to ensure consistency, quality, relevance in qualification standards across the country. Finally, in terms of TVET, the Regulations for Registration of Vocational Education and Training Providers 2020-12, Government Notice 300 of 2012, establish a framework for the registration and regulation of vocational education and training providers in Namibia. The purpose is to ensure that these providers meet specific standards and deliver quality education and training. The regulations apply to all vocational education and training providers, and such providers will need to strictly comply with all these regulations. Notwithstanding the above measures, other already existing mechanisms that ensure that this quality of education is delivered will need to be strictly enforced. Institutions are therefore requested to contact the relevant authorities and to ensure prompt compliance with standards and regulatory requirements. I think that's just fair, isn't it?
Now we come back from that particular explainer, highlighting the particular developments that obviously will come through in terms of 2026. And also citing that all of this is also aimed in the particular announcements that have come through the course of this year. Remember, you can come through after the local engagements or the local content engagement just before we get into the international news segment at 083-288-401. Stepping into our next particular talking point, which gets us into a slightly Namibian and continental discussion, is that the 5th Annual Continental Convention of the Young Women of Africa began on Monday, and that we do have a Namibian present to share Namibian perspectives in Addis Ababa. Now, it takes place at the AU headquarters with the aim of empowering the voices which are sharing the insights and trying to ignite the change that would be necessary. Now, the platform itself, or the organizers, which are the AU in conjunction with other particular affiliated organizations, state that it marks a pivotal moment to engage in meaningful conversation and collaboration focused on reparative justice and the shared prosperity for all young women in Africa. Now, we speak to Dominga Ndala from the Namibian chapter or branch of the Young Women of Africa on the discourse that is currently taking place or that is being shared with regards to the overall agenda of the reparative justice and women's empowerment subject matters. Let's have a listen to this engagement.
And welcoming on the radio session here for today, Tuesday, the 9th of December, specifically just before we have our International Human Rights Day celebrations, we engage with Dominga Ndala, who is the chairperson of the Young Women of Africa Namibian chapter here in Namibia, who's currently participating in a discussion that's based in Addis Ababa. Dominga, I'd like to welcome you and saying thank you for talking to us once again here on Eagle FM.
Thank you, Dwight. It's always a pleasure being here, and good morning to your, or afternoon to your listeners.
100%. Dominga, if we take a look at this particular conference that you're participating in, obviously in Addis today, since Sunday, this particular conference itself, which is based upon young women of Africa and primarily how their roles are featuring into the broader African theme of the reparative justice, that is obviously being sought by the whole continent. And also the greater participation of young women. What were some of the sort of like perspectives and contributions, specifically from your side, firstly, and then some of the other perspectives and contributions that stemmed from Day One's engagement yesterday?
Thank you so much for the question. I think the issue of reparative justice is one that is very close to all African governments. One, because we have gone through colonialism and apartheid, and through those two processes, you have seen that we have lost quite a lot. We have lost land, we have lost our resources, we have lost our identity in some instances, and we have also lost our culture. So I think the AU declaring that this year it's towards reparative justice, it's actually a progressive step, because it means that our African government are very serious and very deliberate with the process of decoloniality. One, two, three, they are very serious with really bringing the dignity of our African people back. You would know that Namibia, like any other African country.
You've leveled up in life, and now it's time to level up your contact. MTC is changing the game with our new contract data plans. More data, more voice minutes, and more SMSs. Core of everything you need. Plans start from just $199 per month. And for a limited new customer's score, an extra 10 gigabytes of data valid for 90 days, absolutely free. Don't wait. Visit any MTC mobile home or call 1200 to level up today. MTC, make the connection.
That Namibia, like any other African country, has also suffered from the atrocities of colonialism and as well as apartheid, like South Africa. And within that perspective, our call has always been that those that have lost land should get back their land. Those that have lost their resources should get it back, because there is a form of reparative justice, and that is also a form of returning the dignity of Africans back. And this is why it's important that we really have this conversation, and we dissect into what does reparative justice really mean from an African perspective. So during our discussion, what we have been doing is to look at the role of women in terms of reparative justice. You would know that every time when there's a war, women and children are the most affected ones. And this goes all around the world. It's the statistics. And this is why it's important that people think that women are always not involved in these processes, but they are the ones that keep the homes even during the war. They are the ones that feed the soldiers that are fighting, and some also joined at the front line. So this is why our discussion was: how do we bring back the dignity of women, and how do we ensure that their voices are occupied in the discussion of reparative justice? What do women need? What is the role of women in bringing back their dignity? You would see that even within the diplomatic space, the role of women in terms of reparative justice, it's not amplified as we wanted it to be. And this is why we are really here in Addis Ababa, to intensify and to amplify our voices, and also to give resolutions to the AU so that they can take it up going forth, that this is the perspective of women, that we want women at the table. We want women also to be in the process of reparative justice. What does it mean from their perspective, and how do they get involved going forth?
It's actually a few good points that you're making there, Dominga, specifically based upon the notions, obviously, of the term young women, because the projections are always that Africa will have a very young population in the future, which is being viewed as the future labor force predominantly. Because I have to give the caveat here that the conversations are always used by the Europeans, by the North Americans, and even by the Asians in that discussion when they cite Africa. Africa will have the youngest population below a certain threshold. And it seems like we've got to be the workforce for in some consideration. It's not clearly stated as it, but it sounds like we must be the workforce for the world. And has such particular indications popped up specifically in the day one deliberations so far of the conference, in terms of how does this factor in the
it almost looks like a burden, because the idea is that we first need to work for Africa before we work for the rest of the world. But has such particular indications popped up yet?
Yes, we had a discussion on economic empowerment, and you rightfully said it. Currently, if we have to look at the stats, around about 60% of the African population are young people under the age of 35. Mm. So it means we really relatively have a young population. One, two, that we should have a very productive workforce. But of course, looking at our socioeconomic factors, you would know that most African youth are unemployed, and they are just not unemployed. Most of them can't get jobs because of we have not expanded our economy, and we have also not sort of industrialized our economy. Right now, as we speak, most African countries, as I was saying, that you would know that 60% of Africa's population are young people under the age of 35, and of course that rightly means that Africa as a continent, they have to capacitate their young people so that they become productive, and then they contribute to the workforce of Africa and also contribute to the world. You would know that African young people are talented, they are capable, and they are in some instances very much educated. And for us, to prevent the brain drain that is currently happening on the African continent, we need to ensure that our government becomes intentionally capacitating our young people, intentional about ensuring that our young people are integrated into the mainstream economy so that they contribute to the economy, to the advancement of the economy, and also by extension to the world. I think in the next 10 years or so, Africa should be the pinnacle of the world. I think this policy that we always come up with, such as Agenda 2063, Vision 2030, should just not be mere papers that African leaders come together and draft about, but should actually be policies that come to reality, and they are then implemented so that this African youth are used in various sectors, whether it's the sectors of energy, technology, mining, and so forth. So I think it's very important that whenever that we convene at such conventions, that we deliberate on these issues, and that we also ensure that African leaders, that we also ensure that the whatever resolutions that were taken are implemented, and African youth are put at the center stage.
Dominga, that's actually also a good particular point, specifically because we constantly, as the continent, and meaning even yourself and myself, as educated Namibians and Africans, we get bombarded with a lot of messages about what other parts of the world look like, and then you can't help but sort of like generate this little bit of envy for why don't we have the level of development that is seen in those media than in other places. Have some of those particular talking points, are they also at the forefront currently for young women in, of the African Continent Conference's particular discussions?
Why is that? We do not see a lot of young women really represented in strategic positions. I think as young women in particular, we just don't want to be used as a measure of tokenism, but we really want to be there at the forefront and also driving the agenda of Africa that we want. And this is why it's important that we are always given this platform to articulate ourselves on issues that we are being affected with, and also to be given an opportunity to really implement the solutions to this problem. You would know that right now, Africa, or young women in Africa, we are still struggling with the issue of child marriage, despite the policies that have been drafted, despite the awareness campaign that have been created around the issue of child marriage. It's still persisting. One of the other issues that is also very prominent is the issue of gender-based violence. And right now, we have even extended it to what we call digital gender-based violence, I think, which is one of the prominent issues that is currently happening. It's just not a Namibian issue. It's also it's also a Southern African issue, and also by extension, an African issue. So these are some of the issues that we are looking at, and we are saying that give us the table. We are ready to take the lead. We are ready to push the women agenda, and we are ready to create policies that speaks to our lived realities and policies that align with our aspiration. And this is why it's important that we are given an opportunity to convene at such places and also just to articulate our policy positions.
Yep, yep. Now, Dominga, I wanted to get now into one of the other particular talking points, the one about peace and security. Obviously, Africa, mm-hmm. the African continent has one major issue specifically with being peaceful, having peaceful mm-hmm. political processes across the continent, because, I mean, just this past weekend, I think before you went to Addis, there was the mm-hmm. Benin coup that, you know, is now being said is somehow being foiled. But before that, it had been the other particular combat situations like Sudan, where women are once again, like you cited at the start of our talk, is one of the major, women and children are one of the major victims. There was obviously the DRC, the Eastern DRC, one of the major talking points was women and children's safety. And how does this particular position factor into the Young Women of Africa discussion based upon peace and security should be at the heart, should be the first thing to be met before we can see the prosperity through economic development? Has that been a reiteration once again?
Yes, I think it's such a coincidence that you asked that question, because yesterday I was actually in the commission where we're talking about peace and security. We had different commissions, and for some reason I chose the issue of peace and security because I'm very passionate about it. And you would see that every now and then there are reoccurring coups on the African continent.
Mm.
And of course, one needs to look at the factors that are contributing to the reoccurrence of coup on the African continent. And when you have to look at it, it's all about lack of governance.
Mm.
It's all about the resources, who gets what and when and how. And it's also all about the inability of African countries to really transform the material conditions of Africans. And when you look at conflicts on the African continent, the ones that are most affected are women and young people.
Mm.
And this is why it's important that if we address these fundamental issues of lack of governance, of resources sharing, of having democratic institutions that speak to the lived realities of African countries, then perhaps we'll see the reduction and conflicts on the African continent. But until then, we do not really address those fundamental issues, or we don't even hold our African countries accountable. I think it's important that if there is any coup or if there is any conflict on the African continent that is being perpetrated by the sitting government, then other African countries should be able to call out those leaders and hold themselves accountable, because the African continent should not be kept like a gentleman's club where friends can't even call themselves out and they support each other on the expense of their citizens. I think that is wrong.
Mm.
And secondly, I think institutions such as the African Union should be given the mandate to have punitive measures against countries, sitting government or sitting presidents that are perpetrating this conflict against their own citizenry or even their own countries. So I think it's important that the issue of peace and security should just not be seen when there's absence of war, but it should be beyond that. And John Galton, one of the philosophers that spoke about the theory of peace, he rightfully say that the absence of war does not mean that there's peace. And this is why peace should go beyond war. We should look at education. We should look at the health.
Mm.
We should look at all other social factors that could increase conflict or that could sort of prompt conflict within a country.
Mm.
So I think the issue of peace and security in Africa should be redefined, and we should look at it from a different perspective, apart only when there is war reoccurring in the country.
And then, Dominga, just before I let you go, specifically, if we look at the last particular point of the socioeconomic development factors, specifically in the human capital development sectors like health and education,
which in many cases is the known methods or the known sectors to invest in so as to ensure that we achieve the workforce of the future leaders, as well as also the future conditions for African countries to prosper. These particular goals in many cases across the continent sometimes have been, they've either been skewed, they've either been ignored, they've either been let down or underfunded. And countries, for example, in the SADC have obviously been sort of like the beacons of this particular example of saying, listen, you need a strong, educated, healthy workforce in terms of achieving your national development goals. And what has been some of the perspectives and impressions coming through from the other African countries that they've cited in this particular talking point?
Of course, the issue of the education sector is very multifaceted and it's very complex. And of course, I think the consensus is there should be implementation of free education, especially in all African countries, looking at our lived realities, looking at the socioeconomic, because we know that an educated population is a very progressive population, and it tends to take it intends to take good decisions that are in the best interest of the populace. And it also contributes to the acceleration of the GDP and all other sectors, within their economy. And this is why, our mandate is all African countries, and this is the consensus, that we should constantly, fund education, the education sector, and we should constantly, promote, courses within the education sector that are relevant to the lived realities of Africa. You would know that Africa is a powerhouse in terms of resources, especially uranium. So this is why it's important that we produce people that understand the uranium sector and they are in the natural be able to sort of produce energy from it. You would know that most African countries, they suffer from load shedding. And this is why it's important that if we develop our uranium sector, it means that Africa will have energy for the next 100 years or so, just like how China is piling up uranium and also keeping it for the next generation. So I think it's important. Also in terms of health, I think what we need to do is to implement a free universal healthcare, because a healthy nation is a productive nation. And if we do not get the basics right, this is how people become frustrated. And then this is how we have a lot of resurgence groups on the African continent. So it's important that those two sectors, they remain well funded. They remain well funded, and we continuously improve those sectors for the betterment of the African people.
And then just leaving on a last particular talking point, bringing you back once again to the reparative justice and the future of this particular conversation between Africa and specifically, and this is specifically aimed at Europe, because Europe is the biggest sort of like, if we can call it sort of like the culprit in this particular discussion, why Africa is having this particular theme of reparative justice. Has there been any sort of like participation by Europe or the EU specifically in the Young Women of Africa conference so far? Or is there still like plans to involve them in future discussions in terms of understanding what methods are they taking to sort of like meet the reparative discussions across the continent?
Yes, of course, because they are hosting us here. They had a chance to participate in the convention. But in terms of them really articulating their position on reparative justice, they have not yet done so. But because they have declared that as the theme of this year, there have been activities towards reparative justice in terms of how do we, like I said, define reparative justice from the African context? What is that we want? How do we build alliance and solidarity amongst those African countries that have been affected as a result of colonialism and apartheid? And how do they support us in that regard? I would know that the African Union this year hosted a reparative justice conference where the Landless People's Movement of Namibia was one of the political parties that have been invited, because they are the first, one of the litigants in the genocide case. And of course, they have also had countries that were that are seeking for reparation. That are seeking for reparation. So those are some of the efforts that the AU has really done. But of course, we are saying that they should have coordinated efforts with all countries, and they should intensify their efforts as in relation to seeking for reparations and reparative justice for African countries.
And just a last talking point, Domingo, on that note. Is there I know it's something that will be an open-ended question, but does it look like there's any sort of like finality to that particular talking point between Africa and Europe?
Excuse me, can you say that again?
Is it just to highlight, I know that's it potentially a subject matter that will take forever or in our lifetime to solve, but has it given any indication in terms of like there would be like a destination, a final year, a final time frame to say, hey, listen, when will Europe, for example, understand its particular impact that it has had in Africa's particular sort of a developmental crisis in many cases?
Oh, I think the discourse of reparation or reparative justice is one that is long term, one that will always be there, even with the next generation. Mm. And this is why it's important that whilst we are in this space, we should amplify our efforts. We should ensure that those that were the perpetrators or those that were involved as a result should understand what reparation means to an African child.
Mm.
It's just not about the money being paid back. It's just not about us reclaiming our land and so forth, but it's about getting back the dignity that has been stolen from us. It's about us really championing what we have lost, or what our forefathers have lost as a result of colonialism and apartheid, and also what we really want our future to be like.
Mm.
So I think it's one that is long-term, and it's one really that will always continue up until the next generation will take over for us. This is why, whilst we are here, we should intensify our fight of reparative justice, and we should make sure that all African countries are on par and we build alliance and a sense of solidarity amongst all of us. There, just yesterday, I was raising the issue that why is it that it's very quick for African countries to call out or to offer their solidarity when a Western country is affected.
Mm.
But our fellow African when it's a fellow African country, we do not do that. Right now, there's an issue of killing in South Sudan.
Mm.
And we have not seen any solidarity towards that.
And even Sudan.
Genocide.
Yeah, even Sudan, yeah.
And Sudan, there's an issue of the genocide case where Namibians, those that have been affected, are asking Germany to apologize to them and to acknowledge that indeed it was a genocide.
Mm.
But there's no solidarity from any African country. So first, I think as African countries, we need to organize ourselves. We need to ensure that this fight is just not against one country, but it's a fight against all African countries. And we need also to intensify the spirit of Ubuntu, because if you go to any other African country, we are faced with the same issues. And this is why it's important that together, if we all collaborate our efforts or have our joint efforts together, then we'll be able to achieve reparations in our lifetime.
And specifically on that note, Domingo, I'd like to thank you for taking. And coming back from that particular engagement there, specifically be with Domingo Ndala from the Young Women of Africa chapter of For Namibia, who's currently in Addis Ababa in terms of the conversations and the particular deliberations taking place right there. Now, stepping into our next item specifically for this midday or drive time session between 1 and 2.30, we engage with Eagle FM's Anakleta Ikeda once again. We did that yesterday based upon an agricultural perspective, but we're doing this again today based upon a discussion of an interesting development, obviously, that came through in the recent local and regional election authority elections that took place 2 weeks back. Anakleta, welcome and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is Anakleta Ikeda reporting from the Kavango region.
And Aketa, so obviously yesterday we had the agricultural discussion based upon communal farmers that have to do their best in terms of utilizing and ensuring that they capitalize on rainfall and putting their plows to work specifically, not having to wait for any particular mechanical assistance. But today we're talking about a very interesting development based upon the successful installation, voting and installation, or election and installation, of three independent candidates across the two Kavango regions. Firstly, for the listeners, you know, why does this look like an interesting development that popped up specifically between the two regions?
In today's top regional political news, the Kavango region have made history in the 2025 regional council election. For the first time, both Kavango East and Kavango West have elected independent councillors, signal a major shift in voters' confidence and political direction. Let's just take a closer look at what this means for local governments and how residents are responding to this, because as we all know, the Kavango region has been known as people that always are voting cows in brackets. But now looking at what have transpired this year in the election is that the people have decided to vote for three independent councillors who are going to represent them in the regional council. And among these three is two are in the Kavango East and one is in the Kavango West. The one in the Kavango West, this is the first time ever, but in the Kavango East, we already had one who is mostly known, Paulus Mbangu, from the Rundu Rula constituency, who is also in the parliament. But this year, he was nominated just to be in the region itself.
And Anakleta, specifically looking at some of the particular talking points that obviously come out of the two regions, because you and I, we have engaged primarily about, you know, what are the needs in the two Kavango regions, and specifically, if we had a look back at, remember the particular school that the Minister of Education and the Prime Minister themselves visited, the school that's about like 5 or 6 kilometers away from Rundu itself, where parents had to take up own initiative to set up that particular installation to just to get education to their kids. What have been some of the talking points or some of the particular needs and wants that community members voted for these independent candidates?
Now, one of the reason why these people, many people have come out in numbers to vote for independent candidate is that they believe that when somebody works independently, they are not controlled by anyone. They do their service independently and willingly. And what Mbangu has demonstrated throughout the 5 years of his being a councillor is he has visited all the villages that is surrounding the Rundu Rula, and he have delivered a lot of services to an extent where he said sometimes he shares his salary with the people who have put him in power. And as we look into the remote areas of the Rundu Rula, people that are residing in the Rundu Rula, they have water, they have boreholes, they have tap water, they have boreholes, they have electricity, which some people don't even have in the informal settlement here in the Rundu urban. And these people have also access to a lot of gardening projects and also green scheme projects, which the independent councillor has already brought to light. Now, this also had motivated a lot of people to say, well, why can't we also get an independent candidate who's also going to bring for us what we have been seeing in the other constituencies that has been happening for our people? Because this, they also believe that putting someone who is independently in power means that you can directly go and talk to him and things can really change, rather than a person that is being controlled or being told or have to wait until services are being delivered, then that's when a person can bring it to you. But when you are independently, you just walk on your own the way you want to walk.
Yep. And just citing specifically, Anacleta, that in the article of yesterday's e-paper specifically, where you highlighted that there was a little bit of an issue with regards to the swearing-in ceremony, specifically around Councillor Mbangu, where he initially didn't want to participate. What was some of the reasoning behind that?
One of the biggest reasons behind it is because when the nominations were done during the election process, is that he the other four members were now the ones that were going to be in the National Council, but him is going to be in the region. So he did not agree per se that he has obtained the highest vote in Kavango region from the one that was in Rundu, where there is more inhabitants, followed by him with 3,000. But the one that was in Rundu, the councillor that was in Rundu, is 7,000. But then those that had less votes were now considered to be at the national level than him, who had more votes, who should just be in the region. So he was not happy about the appointment of him being in the regional management. But
Anacleta, just hold on quickly. We could quickly have an ad break.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Coming back right there, dear listeners. Anacleta, just continue where you left off.
He actually, like I said before, we just went on a break. He declined the appointment to say he's the management to remain in the management committee, stating that he also had the second highest vote from the one that was set as the chairperson of Rundu. So, but despite the hesitation, he ultimately accepted the position. But then he delivered a statement saying that the voice of the people has been shifted, and he added that democratic principles have been cannibalized, thinking that we have no option because there were only two and the other party members were four. So probably he had no choice, and he said, well, he's just going to accept the offer that was given to him to be in the management committee.
100%. And on that note, Anacleta, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk to us once again on the On the Radar.
All right.
Now, getting back to listeners, so that brings us up to the midway point specifically, or actually not the midway point, but sort of like the two-thirds point specifically between 1 and 2 p.m. midday. We'll quickly be taking a short break, and after the break, we'll come back heading into the international news segment. You can still come through at 083-288-401 in terms of sharing your particular perspectives regarding the discussions we've had so far. And we'll see each other on the other side of this particular break.
While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radar News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM,
Now we come back, dear listeners, from the short break right there, and we get into the first caller's contribution. Eagle FM, good afternoon.
Yes, boy.
How are you doing, Uncle Bona?
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm okay, and you, Uncle Bona? How are you doing?
Cool, man. Cool, cool. Very interesting discussion.
Mm.
Yes. Thank God for the democratic space where we have even the independent candidates competing with the purpose of promoting democratic values. Yes, I agree and I appreciate that, their effort. So now my question is there. Yes, I hear from Creta. Oh, Creta, what's your name?
Anna Creta.
Anna Creta. She's informing us very well, and I'm happy with that. Now, this independent candidate. Yes, you mentioned that they also distribute their salary to the needy people. I think that concept it does not denote or have similarities with what is happening in South Africa. There were people who were becoming politicians. Some of them were becoming distractors. And
Angabana, you love that word, ne? The distractors.
You are the one who calls that.
You like that word. But it's okay, it's okay. We get the point. I assume the other listeners get the point, but I get the point, yeah.
Well, then they get it, and then don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, and because of that, so they use some kind of community aid, community assistance, with different people. You know about Brian Mokosi.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know, Angabona. I know. Because I had an interesting discussion even with Matthias about him. Because when Mokgotsi, Brown Mokgotsi, gave his presentation, I told Matthias, read his body language and listen very carefully to how the lawyers, cross-examine him. The reason being, Angabona, because how does someone get mentioned by a high-ranking police general? And specifically being identified as someone that is a go-between between organized crime and the highest authority in a country. And specifically.
All the sectors.
But that this individual specifically is so highly connected, specifically in the security cluster of things of South Africa, and the basic mistakes that the person makes in a cross-examination. For example, like not knowing how to fill in a form that asks, where do you live? Angabona?
So, can you see those things? Those are the things that we need to guard against.
Yeah.
So that we don't unnecessarily fall into problems. And we need to make sure that, yes, as we are serving the community, we should not under the pressure that, yes, we have money, because we know already that we don't have the structure. Or do they have the structures? We think that there is some kind of formal structure where they can really help people, things like that. And we know that these are genuine kind of solidarity kind of programs, unlike where they are saying, you know, because if they hide, and you remember that guy, he had to capture most of the community because with the blood money. And what has happened? You can see almost the chaos.
Yeah.
How they frustrated in the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And the whole things actually. So fine, let them campaign and do all these things, but sometimes we really need to scrutinize them. If they don't have the structure, the former trust. Fine, they can serve the community just like the way I'm serving the community. Or any other person. But all what we want, we are trying to avoid issues of destabilization through this kind of activity. So that's what I'm cautioning the people to be aware. They trust their democratic
Angabona, are you moving about? Just stand still. Just stand still, Angabona.
So let me start.
It's clear now.
I'm in the mountain now.
Now it's clear. It's clear now. Yeah, if you stand still.
So let's tell the community, let's not bribe them with our salaries. Why can't you bribe them?
I knew it, Angapona. I knew it. I don't know why you had to take me to Korekhas to get to the point, but I knew you would get there. All right. I hear you, Angapona. But yeah, continue where you were ending off.
Because if you do that, that's the brand for me.
I still don't know why you had to take me to Korekhas all the way. But yeah.
That's why I like your program. So please let me hear for a while.
Not a problem, Angapona. Thanks for coming through. Thanks for coming through. Now, dear listeners, that's obviously in terms of understanding the discussions, and obviously that's what we do here at Eagle FM. Do remember that obviously, you know, we do this with also a discussion of staying objective and sort of like in the middle of the path discussions with regards to engagement. If you still have an opportunity to come through at 083-288-401. If not, we continue still with the international news segment and specifically turning to developments coming through from around the continent. Now, this is as developments have come through from Nigeria specifically, where it has come to light that some 100 abducted children have been freed. Now, about 100 school children who had been abducted from a Catholic school in northwestern Nigeria are free again and will soon be reunited with their family. Now, the children have now been handed over to the officials in the Niger state, and last month, armed men kidnapped 315 school children and staff from the St. Mary's Catholic Primary and Secondary School in the town of Papiri. Some 155 pupils and teachers are still being held captive. Let's have a listen to this engagement.
From a Catholic school in northwestern Nigeria are free again and will soon be reunited with their loved ones. The children have now been handed over to officials in Niger State. Last month, armed men kidnapped 315 school children and staff from St. Mary's Catholic Primary and Secondary School in the town of Papiri. Some 155 pupils and teachers are still being held.
All right, I want to go now to Amaka Okoye, DEW's bureau chief in Lagos, Nigeria. Amaka, what more have we learned from Nigerian authorities tonight?
Thank you very much, Brent. Not so much has been said, actually, from the authorities, especially particularly relating to this release or rescue. There's been a lot of semantics going on, release, rescue efforts. And so you can attribute it to the lot of criticism that the Nigerian government got already when they rescued the previous 25 or 24 girls from the Kebbi State. And so during this time, we really have not heard so much, especially regarding the efforts, how they were released, what happened. In fact, we realized that they were released at some point late last night, and they moved them from, you know, the Federal Capital Territory, Abuja, now to the state capital where they are. So not so much has been said, and one of the governors was saying to local media earlier that they're not saying so much so that they don't reveal their, you know, security strategy. But of course, yes, people are happy. Nigerians are happy, if you like, that 100 of these children are back and, you know, that they were taking, but there's still so many, there are so many questions about how did they come back.
Yeah, I want to pick up, too, on the fact that it is not all clear tonight. There are children who remain abducted and in captivity. What can you tell us about the efforts to release them?
That's right, and this is why a lot of question has been going on how, why are they being released in tranches? First of all, it was 50 that escaped, and now, of course, this 100 that are now, you know, released to the parents who will soon be having them reunited. And so many people are asking, how did this happen? Is it negotiated effort? You would recall that the National Security Advisor visited, you know, the parents 2 weeks ago recently and assured them that their children will be back. Of course, he didn't say so much of how that is going to happen, but again, they say there's the federal government played a key role in getting them out. So not so much is being let out to the public, you know, how this this coordination, if you like, is going on, whether it's negotiation, whether ransom is being paid, whether even the terrorists or the armed men or the culprits are being held or arrested. Not so much information is out there, really.
Our DW Bureau Chief in Lagos, Nigeria, Amaka Okoye, reporting for us tonight with some good news on the situation of those abducted school.
Now, coming back, dear listeners, we step into a global discussion specifically with the recently released North American or American strategy towards Europe. Now, this is as discussions have been ongoing between Europe and the United States about this released national security strategy document, as the particular discussion highlights that it seems like there is a break from the past when the U.S. decided to emphasize spreading democracy. Now, it's particularly critical of Europe, leading to the question of, does the U.S. now see itself not as Europe's partner, but as a rival? We have a listen to this discussion.
Rejected accusations leveled at Europe in the new U.S. security strategy. A government spokesman says the document, which was published last week, is largely driven by ideology rather than real strategy. It accuses European allies of censorship and attacking liberty and says Europe faces, quote, civilizational erasure. So does the U.S. now see itself not as Europe's partner, but as a rival? For more on this, we can speak now with Brando Benife. He's an Italian member of the European Parliament with the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats, and he chairs the Parliament's Delegation for Relations with the United States. Welcome to DW. So, Mr. Benife, we just heard Donald Trump there doubling down on a key theme in his new national security strategy, and that is that Europe is headed in a bad direction and needs U.S. prodding to get back on track. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's our transatlantic ally, the United States, that is in fact going in a bad direction in the sense that proposing such a national security strategy with such a harsh and extreme sentences regarding the European Union specifically is something that is not helpful for what we have to do together. I am the chair of the Delegation for the Relations with the United States, and now we are following very closely the issue of the trade relations, and we see it clearly that we need to find solutions together, and these kind of messages are hindering the complex negotiations that are now on the table. And when we see an attack on our digital sovereignty, because that's another front of this discussion, we see a backlash coming from our citizens and our governments, and some of them try to stay away from rebutting to this discourse, but it becomes impossible at some point, because in fact right. We have seen that the initial approach that we have seen from people like Callas that you have made heard earlier, it has been welcomed with further tension, with further escalation. So we need to put some answer to what we have heard, because we need to reaffirm that we cannot be pushed in an angle by our transatlantic ally.
Well, maybe you can help us with some of those answers. The strategy document calls Europe's path civilizational erasure through migration and censorship. First of all, were you surprised to see that kind of language in this document?
This kind of language is the language I hear when I go to Washington and meet with ultranationalists, members of Congress, or with some think tanks that are in the Washington bubble. It's important to talk to these people, to have an exchange, but this was never an official way of writing of the administration, because, to be frank, some form of interference, electoral interference, already happened. Think of the candidate and now president of Poland that was received by the White House during the electoral campaign. And if we go back, we could see the acts of Elon Musk during the UK campaign. But right. This is another step. It's putting in written that they want to interfere on our internal politics, because it says that there must be support for movements that resist this wrong trajectory of the European Union. And it's identifying the European Union as the problem for Europe. But unfortunately, European Union is in fact the one that has to negotiate with the US. So this is not helpful. I mean, in the next days, I will meet online with representatives from Congress, and I will meet also with the new ambassador of US to the EU in person. And I will convey this message. This is not helpful for what we need to do together. And be sure that we will not allow our sovereignty to be overstepped. At least I would say there are people that think so. And we will push also our governments to be a bit more assertive, because we also need to send a message to our people. Some people are starting to think that US and Russia, they will find some agreement together. Look at Ukraine, but more broadly as powers, they will decide, and the EU has only to wait and accept. This is something we can't go in terms of direction, because it will be the end of European sovereignty.
As head of the EU Parliament's delegation for US relations, how would you describe the transatlantic bond at this point, and what needs to happen in order to make it better?
Well, I want to be pragmatic and realistic. I don't think we will change the course of the administration very much, although we must clarify that putting on an official text such phrases is unacceptable and must be retracted. But let's be realistic again. I think the main thing for us is to build more unity, more sovereignty, more pool the capacity of action from security to investments to common fiscal capacity to a more integrated European market, to be able to stand together in front of a complicated ally as it is today, the United States. Because if we stay fragmented, if we keep the EU as it is today, where all our government leaders are only looking for the next elections, they are ill of short-termism, I think we will never succeed in building a future for our union. And so I think it's very important that we take a step forward in sovereignty together, which means also doing what Mario Draghi was presenting in his report, not only simplifying rules, but also building common initiatives, not accepting anymore to have a veto power by one country on foreign policy issues, for example, building more common initiative. I think we really need to go in this direction.
European parliamentarian Brando Benny.
Now we come back from that particular engagement right there, and stepping into another one based upon a trade discussion that has popped up between the United States and China, where the US is set to allow the exports of advanced artificial intelligence chips to China. Now this is as US President Donald Trump on Monday indicated that he would allow the exportation of US chipmaker Nvidia's second most powerful AI chips to China, in spite of criticism, saying that such a move could end up benefiting Beijing's military. Now Trump said the US would collect a 25% fee on these sales, and added that he'd informed Chinese leader Xi Jinping of this particular decision. Let's have a listen to this engagement.
In the studio with us. Morning to you, Charles.
Morning.
We're kicking off with Donald Trump, who's allowing the export of advanced artificial intelligence chips to China. Walk us through that.
So the decision settles a debate that pitted those who wanted to completely stop these exports for national security reasons, as these chips could help Beijing supercharge their military, and those who said U.S. AI chip makers like Nvidia needed access to the Chinese market in order to maintain their dominance in the sector. U.S. President Donald Trump made the announcement in a social media post on Monday, saying it will allow Nvidia's second most powerful AI chip, the H200 processor, to be exported to China, but that the U.S. government will collect a 25% fee on those sales, adding that the move will protect national security, create American jobs, and keep America's lead in AI. Details still need to be finalized, notably conditions for shipment or whether there will be a limit to the amount of chips that can be authorized.
Well, so what are the likely consequences of powerful AI chips to China, Charles?
Well, first I wanted to look at the reactions to this announcement. NVIDIA, in a statement offering the H200 chips, said that it would that this would approve to customers to said allowing these chips to approve customers strikes a thoughtful balance that is great for America. But the reaction in the political sphere has not been so positive. A group of Democratic senators described the decision as a colossal economic and national security failure that would boost China's AI industry, notably rivals to OpenAI like DeepSeek, and its military. Even Republican representatives John Molinar criticized the move, saying that China will rip off NVIDIA's technology, mass produce it themselves, and then seek to end NVIDIA as a competitor.
All right, so let's think a little bit about how those consequences are going to, you know, play out with these AI chips in China.
So a nonpartisan think tank, the Institute for Progress, actually looked into this in a report published on Sunday. And among the key implications they outlined were the fact that China would have access to chips that outperform any it can produce domestically, that its AI labs would be able to build AI supercomputers that achieve performance similar to U.S. supercomputers. And finally, that this wouldn't slow down China's efforts to be more self-reliant when it comes to semiconductor design and manufacturing. So it's unclear whether this U.S. decision will actually lead to new sales in China, as Beijing has been telling its companies not to use U.S. technology.
Well, Shah, here in Europe, fears have been growing about the continent's automobile industry steadily being obliterated, it has to be said, by competition once again coming from China.
Mm-hmm. This year, the European Union imported more cars from China than it exported to the country. It's a historic first, and it applies to auto parts as well. While its exports to the U.S. have cratered amid a trade war with the Trump administration, China's trade surplus with the EU is up some 15% this year, with some European leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron, to suggest the bloc may need to roll out hefty tariffs of its own to protect its endangered manufacturing base. Brian Quinn and our colleagues at France Télévisions take a closer look.
For his next company car, this French businessman has chosen...
Now, coming back from that particular engagement right there, dear listeners, we obviously get into the last of our international segment items, and that's specifically heading into West Africa, where there is the discussion of aging leaders that are facing growing youth frustrations. Now, the Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara has been inaugurated for a fourth term after an election marked by low turnout and unrest, and it comes a day after the attempted coup that took place in Benin, deepening a regional crisis and testing democracy in West Africa that is already taken or shaken by six coups in 4 years. Let's have a listen to this particular engagement.
Ivory Coast's President Alassane Ouattara's inauguration and wonders if anyone else sees what she's seeing, a ceremony that looks more like a birthday party for the elderly. She squints and scans the room. Nope. No women in sight, no one under 60.
Old man, without hair.
After a contested election, Ouattara, who's 82, is warmly congratulated by the Republic of Congo's president, Sassou Nguesso, also 82, in power since 1979. And then there's the younger 78-year-old president of Djibouti. Cameroon's 92-year-old newly re-elected president sends his blessings. An elderly caste presiding over nations where most people are 18 or younger, a generation, Dabo says, that refuses to step aside.
And it's not representative of the majority of the median age of the sub-region. And seeing Ouattara being inaugurated for a fourth term is being used as justification for coups happening in the sub-region. Because we've come to a point where most citizens believe that the only way to topple this system that's entrenched or corrupt is through military rule.
Six coups in 4 years. The latest attempt was on Sunday in Benin, where young officers briefly claimed power, citing mismanagement of the country and a breakdown in governance as their motivation. Shortly after, Nigerian warplanes, as part of the regional bloc ECOWAS, struck the coup plotters and restored the president. It's a reminder that instability isn't only coming from the top, it's coming from below, from a generation losing patience. According to the EU, a record 239,000 people tried to make it to Europe illegally last year. Many were young West Africans.
Walk to any street corner in West Africa and one thing stands out.
the work is being done mostly by the young. This is a generation that has lost faith in democracy, promised jobs that never came, and so they're leaving in numbers, escaping not war, but a system they say is rigged against them.
Ivorian artist Placide Gonon puts it bluntly in his lyrics. We grow up fast, but our countries grow old. Power sits while our future run out. The elders hold the throne, but we hold the hunger, and hunger doesn't wait for elections.
We are in a republic, we are not in a monarchy. In the monarchy it is the king, but in a republic it is the people. But no one here is taking people into account.
In his speech, Ouattara says it's time to hand power to women and the young. But by the end of his mandate, he'll be 88 in a country where most citizens won't even be old enough to vote. The question now is whether the next generation will inherit power or just the promise of it. Nicholas Hawke, Al Jazeera.
Now, on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for today's particular discussion here on the radar for this Tuesday session. You can catch us once again, same time, same place tomorrow, once again, on the Wednesday edition. Do remember just to act a little bit safer, act a little bit moderate, in even though it might be a public holiday tomorrow, which would be the 10th of December, that being International Human Rights Day celebrations. Fun fact, the rest of the world decides to celebrate International Human Rights Day on the 10th of December, but the South Africans went and for some reason decided to go and slot it in the first half of the year. Obviously, as the 10th of December already with them is a different kind of a public holiday on that note. And ending up on that particular discussion, dear listeners, let's see each other again, same time, same place. Enjoy the rest of your programming in our company, and let's see each other again tomorrow here on your number one talk radio station, or alternatively, during the course of the programming as always, or during the course of the week. And remember to tune in and obviously listen to your favorite programming here on Eagle FM.